also found this pepper that looks like you, Yael.
Thanks, Don. Since tomatoes and peppers are closely related, it will be interesting to see if and how the sun gene functions in peppers and other fruits.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University.
Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger with help from Kevin Livingstone at Trinity University. I'm Yael Cassander.
And I'm Don Glass.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. This Saturday's wine tasting lineup includes a wide selection of California wines from the familiar to the new. More information at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com.
It's 241, 87 degrees in Urbana. In sports this afternoon, the Tour de France was rocked with more controversy today. Italian rider Riccardo Ricco was detained by police before today's 12th stage for testing positive for EPO. Britain's Mark Cavendish was the winner of today's stage. China's basketball team is looking a lot better today. Center Yao Ming took part in his first game since suffering a stress fracture in his left foot last February. The Houston Rockets big man had 11 points in just over 12 minutes as the Chinese national team played a game with a Serbian squad. The St. Louis Blues have signed free agent defenseman Andy Wojnarowski. He had 2 goals and 7 assists last year. And the 2008 Major League Baseball season resumes tonight with 4 games. The first games after the All-Star break feature Detroit playing at Baltimore, Cincinnati at home to the New York Mets, San Diego at St. Louis, and Colorado at home to Pittsburgh. That's sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handcrafts and telling their stories in North America.
The U.S. military is spreading one of history's most powerful weapons in Iraq. The weapon in question is not a gun or a bomb. It is the ability to read and write. Americans are passing on that skill in a northern city called Hawija. They're teaching it to Sunni militiamen. These are gunmen who might have once opposed the United States. Now they're a part of what is called the Awakening Movement, and their members are paid by the U.S. to run a neighborhood watch. NPR's Nishant Dahiya explains why their training now includes literacy.
Young boys and girls chanting the Arabic alphabet are a common sight in schools across Iraq. But these are no ordinary students. They are, for the most part, young men in their mid-20s. Some are in their 30s, dressed in green camouflage uniforms. They are part of the Awakening Movement, Sunni tribesmen, some of them former insurgents, who now work alongside U.S. forces to secure their neighborhoods. The literacy project here is part of a pilot program set up by the U.S. military and run by local Iraqis. About 500 men across the district are being trained in this first phase, and classes began in mid-June. 25-year-old Mahmoud Salah Hassan has been part of the Awakening Movement for 2 months now. He says the classes are helping him.
It's very good. I'm improving. It's basic reading like boy, girl, sun, moon.
And while the course is indeed basic, First Lieutenant Stephen Johnson from the 443rd Civil Affairs Battalion, who helped set up the program, says that's just what the pilot project is aiming for.
This particular pilot is geared towards getting them to achieve the third or fourth grade education level in reading, writing, and math.
Johnson hopes the training will give these young men a better shot in the job market. The ultimate objective, he says, is to enable them to pass a basic literacy test that would make them eligible to join the Iraqi security forces. The Awakening Movement has been an integral part of the U.S. military strategy against al-Qaeda in Iraq. Integrating the militiamen into the Iraqi security forces would not only provide them permanent jobs, it would also help with the reconciliation process. But as Lieutenant Johnson acknowledges, there are still doubts about the program.
This initial pilot is geared towards transitioning them into the Iraqi security forces. At this time, that has not been guaranteed.
Iraq's Shiite-led government has been reluctant to integrate the Sunni militiamen into the state security forces. So far, only a fraction of the nearly 100,000 Awakening members have been inducted into the police and army. But according to Dr. Ala Maki, head of the Education Committee in the Iraqi parliament, the government is getting serious about it.
Yes, it is a serious desire, and we want to educate them and making them ready to be incorporated in Iraqi army and Iraqi security forces and Minister of Interior.
Another goal is to make this U.S.-funded pilot project the model for a nationwide literacy program, this one wholly funded by the Iraqi government. Dr. Mackey again.
This program will spread all over Iraq, the beginning in Hawija, and later on we will expand all over Iraqi provinces.
If and when the program does expand, Dr. Mackey says it will not be limited to the awakening groups. It is intended to help all Iraqis, about 5.6 million of whom are illiterate. Nishant here, NPR News.
In the books of the thriller writer Chelsea Kane, the city of Portland, Oregon is a character, and that character is a woman, a hottie in hiking boots with complicated relationships. Also, as imagined by the author, Portland is a haunted woman. NPR senior correspondent Ketzel Levine toured the dark town with Chelsea Kane.
This much I know. She likes being noticed, even on this empty beach along the Columbia River. The silk scarf loose around her neck trails her like Dior, poison. Her dark glasses and vamp lipstick are startling as the wind whips her unnaturally honeyed hair.
I started walking here with my mom, and I actually came to Portland when my mom was dying of cancer. That's how I moved to Portland. So right away I had this sort of mixed relationship with the city.
Chelsea Kane may fly her sentences like kites, but she is no dippy dame.
I often, when I am walking in the wilderness, keep my eye open for bodies. I do. Ever since I was a kid. You know, I think I read too many Nancy Drew books to start, and it went from there. You know, you never know when you might come across a dead body. And the converse of that is to think, well, where is a good place to dump a dead body?
She points to a mound of sand. I know where this is heading. Heartsick. I've read the book.
She'd been strangled and then soaked in bleach like the others. She lay 5 feet from the water's edge, on her back, head to the side. One leg was slightly bent, the other straight, tangled in river weed.
An unholy mess on a stretch of sand and sunshine. Why is Chelsea Kane dreamt a corpse into being here on Portland's pastoral Sauvie Island, 10 miles west in a twilight zone from urban woe? Then it hits me like a pail of you-pick berries. Beauty kills.
People come to Portland, many of them, for the quality of life. And yet, you know, every year, people climbing a mountain get killed by avalanches. And I think that there's just a really interesting tension in the fact that there's this incredibly beautiful environment all around us that picks people off one by one.
Frankly, it's a relief to be back in the city. Truth is, it's a little unnerving being alone with Chelsea Kane. Her dark side is as startling as silence on the radio. You see what I mean. The leafy boulevards of downtown Portland are not among Chelsea Kane's crime scenes yet. So far, she's only published the one thriller, Heartsick. But I've a bad feeling. That's why we're about to sneak in where we're not supposed to be.
I feel like somebody's going to come around the corner and bust us.
Just act naturally, you guys.
We're in a club, members only. Gail Hayes Davis got us in. A woman with the looks of a trophy wife and the brains of a school principal.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Turns out, she was one. We're here because this place, the Arlington Club, will figure in Chelsea Kane's sequel, a book no one has yet seen.
The detective at one point and the journalist come and stay here. There's a serial killer on the loose, and they're in danger. So they put them in the Arlington for safekeeping.
Yes, you can't get in without being noticed.
It's like the Berlin Wall. They shoot you if you come across
them. No.
Thinking to walk out before getting thrown out, I make our excuses. Next stop, Portland's densely wooded refuge, its name, Forest Park.
Careful. Come on, let's get a pass.
This is where we're meeting a friend of Chelsea Kane's, writer Susie Vitelli, who holds in her hand a cheap, shiny paperback. It isn't. It is. It's Sweetheart, the sequel, and it's due out this fall.
Forest Park was pretty in the summer. Portland's ash sky was barely visible behind a canopy of aspens, hemlock, cedars, and maples that filtered with the light to a shimmering pale green. The creek hummed and churned. Birds chirped. It was all very lovely, very Walden, except for the corpse.
Something's not quite right about this Susie Vitelli. This much I know. She's no innocent. The woman's too quick to agree that this model train set of a city could contain such evil.
The books that are set in Portland aren't generally in this genre. And so this is sort of breaking new ground. And I think it's helping to broaden people's idea of what's here.
None for the good. That's my take. I see the city's jewel, Forest Park. She and her writing buddy see a graveyard.
I'm sure there are bodies just waiting to be dug up.
Are you serious?
I'm sure.
Bodies in Forest Park? It's 5,000 acres. There are at least five bodies in this park right now.
I would agree.
Oh, please. Bodies. Yet Chelsea Kane won't relent. She dares me to come back with her alone. Tonight, she will hold the flashlight.
Chelsea, put the light on.
Sorry.
We have been here before, but now it's pitch black and we're heading into Forest Park.
Are you scared?
I'm a little uncomfortable.
Hear that creak?
And the air is exquisite. It's not very ominous. So why thrillers?
It was a story, you know? I mean, I love scary stories. See if we can get up here?
Okay. You lead the way.
Oh, look at this. Somebody was buried alive here. And this
Stop
is the
it.
Pipe we're allowed to breathe through. It's okay. You know how I talked about the bodies in Forest Park? I think we're the bodies that we're looking for. Okay. I'm going to go down and then I'm going to shine the flashlight up. So I'm going to leave you for just a moment, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
You know, an imagination like this woman's, when you start walking in the park at night with a flashlight, you can understand what she comes up with, even in a beautiful, idyllic place like Portland.
That was NPR senior correspondent Ketzel Levine off the beaten path in Portland, Oregon's Forest Park with writer Chelsea Kane. For the epilogue to Ketzel's Night Wandering Portland's Forest Park with Chelsea Kane, and to read an excerpt of Heartsick, go to npr.org. It's 2:52. There's a change going on in the religions of the world. More people are hearing a green message when they go to their place of worship. Mark Brush reports major religious leaders are spreading a message of caring for the earth.
The Dalai Lama is talking about the environment, and tens of thousands of people are packed into this basketball arena to hear his message. This kind of a talk is a natural fit. In the Buddhist tradition, all sentient life forms are sacred. So you might not be surprised to hear that the Dalai Lama thinks we need to cut our cravings for more and more material stuff.
We always want more and more, 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 more like that. So I think some lifestyle, I think have to change. But this is not my business.
This kind of a message is now coming from other religions, too. The Vatican recently declared pollution a sin. And when he went to the United Nations, the Pope told international leaders to work together on climate change and environmental protection. And many Protestants are now spreading the green gospel. And it's not just the more liberal members of the church. Leaders on the left and the right are going beyond the pulpit to preach about the environment. You can even catch them on primetime TV. Here's a clip from a commercial by WeCanSolveIt.org. Preachers Al Sharpton and Pat Robertson sit side by side on a couch by the ocean.
Al, let's face it. We're polar opposites.
We couldn't be further apart. I'm on the left.
And I'm usually right. And we strongly disagree.
Except on one issue. Tell them what it is, Reverend Pat.
That would be our planet. Taking care of it is extremely important.
While this is a new topic for some religious leaders, other groups have been working for a long time to green the church. The Evangelical Environmental Network promotes something called creation care, and they faced a lot of pushback when they first started. Jim Ball is the president of the network. He says the environment was largely ignored by evangelicals, but now that's changed. As proof, he says 120 senior evangelical leaders signed on to an initiative that promises to do something about climate change, and he says many of them are quite conservative. Ball says they started to change their minds when they got an earful from their own kids and grandkids.
So it was the younger generation saying to some of these senior leaders, you know, you really need to stop just looking at this and saying, you know, that's for other people. you've got to look at this and understand this is a serious problem.
But not everyone is accepting this green sermon. Some in the Christian church point to the book of Genesis and believe that man should have dominion over nature. They think environmentalism goes beyond tree-hugging and actually promotes worship of nature instead of God. Andy Hoffman is a professor at the University of Michigan who speaks on religion and the environment. He says these kinds of interpretations of the Bible prevent many people from taking environmental issues seriously.
Many religious people are skeptical or cautious about environmentalism. They look at people who care about the environment as deifying the environment, and therefore they see a challenge there, and that's really not the case. It's completely consistent to be a devout Christian or a devout Jew or a devout Muslim and care about the environment and have those two mesh quite nicely. So to have religious leaders come forward and articulate this viewpoint dispels that myth and takes away that problem.
Hoffman says these religious leaders connect people to their moral values. And if caring for the environment is part of that, it can go a long way in changing the way people live. For the Environment Report, I'm Mark Brush.
And this Sunday afternoon at 5, we hope you'll join us for a live broadcast of Keeping the Faith. Each week, host Steve Shoemaker and his guests explore issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. This week, Steve's guest is Professor Dennis Dooling, and the topic is the Gospel of Matthew. That's Keeping the Faith, Sunday afternoons at 5, here on AM 580.
Earth and Sky.
Thursday, July 17th, 2008. The moon reaches the crest of its full phase at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, Universal Time.
For the Americas, that means the moon will be most full in the wee hours before sunrise Friday morning. We in the Northern Hemisphere call the July full moon the Thunder Moon.
No matter where you live, the moon will look full tonight and tomorrow. And near the moon, you'll see Jupiter, the king of planets. Jupiter lies 5 times farther from the sun than Earth, but this world is the 4th brightest light in our sky after the sun, moon, and planet Venus.
Unlike the stars, which shine with their own light, the moon and Jupiter shine by reflecting sunlight. Jupiter looks bright because it's big and its surface is covered with very reflective clouds. Jupiter could hold 1,300 of our Earths, and it reflects more than 50% of sunlight striking its clouds.
In contrast to Jupiter, the moon is small and dull. 50 moons could fit inside Earth, and the moon reflects only 12% of incoming sunlight. The moon looks big and bright to us only because it's nearby. The moon is about 400,000 kilometers or 250,000 miles away.
Meanwhile, Jupiter lies more than 1,500 times the moon's distance tonight. We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
And chances are good that